WAI.org online. The clock slowly ticks up to 1 p.m., which means that we have to get ready for Leonard Lopate at Large. So we're about to do that right about now, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate, and I'm hearing myself in my headphones. So, Reggie, could you please correct that? Thank you. Although the United States is recognizing... Oh, gosh, I can't go on if I keep on hearing myself. I'm hearing an echo of myself. Reggie?
Leonard?
Yeah, fix it, yeah, please. Yeah.
Well, I'm doing what I can do over here. We'll try. Okay, try it now.
Okay.
Can you hear?
I'm still hearing. Although the United States is recognized as the most religiously diverse country in the world, actually, many of its laws and customs reflect a very different reality. That's what Kiathi Y. Joshi, a professor of education at Fairleigh Dickinson, argues in her latest book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. It's published by New York University Press and brings Professor Joshi to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, Leonard.
I'm sorry we had that little problem, but it's been worked out.
Wonderful.
You argue that in U.S. society, Christianity, and particularly Protestantism, sets the tone and establishes the rules and assumptions about who belongs and who does not, and about what's acceptable and not acceptable in public discourse. But hasn't religious belief always been a part of this country's national identity?
It has been, but it's not always been recognized as such. I think because we have freedom of religion in the First Amendment, a lot of people believe that we actually have been religion neutral all along from the time the Republic was created, and that's not been the case. Christianity has been there from the get-go, and actually whiteness and Christianity together have been embedded in public policy, Supreme Court decisions, laws related to immigration and citizenship and so on.
And it's even on our currency, and God We Trust is on all of our currency. And in my lifetime, the phrase under God was inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance as a way, I guess, of distinguishing us from godless communism. But I actually found what President Eisenhower said when he signed the bill, and this is kind of eye-opening. He said, from this day forward, the millions of our school children will daily proclaim in every city and town, every village and rural schoolhouse, the dedication of our nation and our people to the Almighty. In this way, we are reaffirming the transcendence of religious faith in American heritage and future. In this way, we shall constantly strengthen those spiritual weapons, which forever will be our country's most powerful resource in peace or in war.
That's right. That's right.
Well, that sounds very religious for a country that supposedly has religious freedom for all. I guess maybe it doesn't include atheists and agnostics.
Right, and atheists and agnostics would probably be talking to you about religious privilege, and I'm here talking to you about Christian privilege, right? And I think that the example you bring up in terms of what President Eisenhower said is the exact kind of information that isn't taught, that is lacking in our education around religion, around race, which inhibits us from getting the full picture of what's going on and what has been going on.
There are also religions that believe in more than one God. How have the courts interpreted the constitutional guarantee of freedom of religion? Obviously not freedom from religion.
Well, we really can see Christian normativity arise in several cases. If you take the case where the peyote case where Native Americans were fired because they had ingested peyote and then failed a drug test. That's a ritual. That's a ritual that's not there in Protestant faiths, but but it was part of their faith, but wasn't recognized as such. So one of the things I talk about in the book is the fact that so many of our pivotal cases around religion have been interpreted through a Christian lens because that's the framework the justices were working from. So that gets us to the idea of, you know, it shows right then and there why diversity of voice, why diversity of representation is critical when so many important decisions are being made.
Are the words white, Christian, and American often used interchangeably, often in subtle ways that society doesn't even notice?
Yes, they really are. Sometimes it's covertly done. Sometimes it's overtly done. I mean, to be American really has meant to be white and Christian. And actually, that goes back to one of our first laws. The Naturalization Act of 1790 said you had to be a free white man to be a citizen of this country. And then in 1795, an amendment was made that said the language was brought in, a free white man of good moral character, right? So there we start seeing in explicit language morality, i.e. Christianness, coming in. And that's who could be a citizen. There were changes along the way. African Americans gained the right to citizenship with the 14th Amendment and 1870 Naturalization Act. But, you know, the discussions, when you look at the primary source documents around the discussions that were happening in terms of African Americans getting citizenship, there was a sense, since many of them had converted to Christianity, since many of them had accepted Christ, it would be okay for them to have citizenship. And a real stark line was drawn between African Americans getting citizenship and how Native Americans and Chinese should not. The discussions I'm referring to are some of the ones coming out of California at the time. And Native Americans didn't get citizenship until 1924, and Chinese didn't get citizenship until 1943.
Now, was Christian privilege something you were aware of when you were growing up a Hindu in Atlanta in the 1980s?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I did experience a fair amount of white Christian privilege, though I didn't know that's what it was. I just didn't fit in. I was a brown little Hindu girl growing up in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia. And honestly, I wasn't black and I wasn't white. So,
and you were a Native American.
And you were Latino. Native American, although sometimes people thought that. And people continue to still think that when some of us identify as Indian and Indian American. And when I said I was Hindu, or my family would say they were Hindu, you know, you got these kind of quizzical looks on people's faces. And I really faced a tremendous amount of bullying and harassment in middle school and high school for being different. All the while, though, I had a very strong Indian American Hindu community, thankfully. So I was very proud of my religion and culture, just not at school, and I would have done anything to not have brown skin.
Is the South a special case? Would Atlanta have been considered part of the Bible Belt in the 1980s? And I was just thinking about the proposed new state flag for Mississippi, which will remove the image of the Confederate flag, but now we'll use the word, we'll incorporate the words, "In God We Trust."
Right. We're seeing white Christian privilege everywhere, literally day by day, you know, right now. What I experienced should not be seen as, well, you grew up in the South and that's why this happened. We have data. I have gathered it myself. That became my first book. Of these kind of experiences that were all over the United States, particularly up and down the East Coast, which is where I interviewed people. And it wasn't just in the 80s. Later on, in the late 90s, I was getting married and very much experienced white privilege, Christian privilege, and white Christian privilege because I was marrying a white Christian man. He's Episcopalian. And we wanted to have an interfaith ceremony. His minister would not marry us, So we found someone. So we did officially finally have a Hindu priest and a Methodist minister officiating together, but we couldn't find a venue to hold it because we didn't want to do it in a house of worship. We were turned away from hotels for a variety of reasons. They didn't say it was about the food in some cases, but people brought up issues around food. We let people know that in the Hindu part of the ceremony, we would have to have a hoven, Leonard, and that's a small fire. But honestly, I really believe people heard that we were going to have a huge bonfire instead of trying to understand what we were saying. And we couldn't find a place. Finally, the hotel that we had our wedding was owned by an Indian Muslim man who, not coincidentally, was familiar with what a hoven is. And he called up the fire chief and said, listen, we're going to have this. Can you help us out? Fire chief said, hey, no problem. And they just kind of stayed on ready alert, if you will, because they turned off the sprinkler system for about 8 or 9 minutes during the ceremony. You know, so there was a will there. Other places didn't even bother to try to understand what they could do. They just said, oh, fire marshal won't allow it.
In recent years, haven't we been moving away from some of the things we're talking about to some degree with the repeal of blue laws in most states? Haven't the courts decided that the Sunday laws were a form of discrimination against religions that don't celebrate Sunday as their Sabbath? And now in New York, for example, and I get a number of other states, you can buy alcohol on Sunday. You can shops can stay open on Sunday. They in New York, when I was a kid, that wasn't the case.
Yeah, I when I grew up in Georgia, you couldn't buy alcohol on Sundays, and now it has changed somewhat. But, you know, I'm in northern Jersey, and in Bergen County, we still have the blue laws where shops are closed on Sundays.
Really?
The thing is, though, is that, you know, the Christianity is deeply embedded, right, in our social and legal structures. So while blue laws have been rescinded in some cases, it's also about looking at how Christianity is kind of just part of our, a part of the air we breathe. We're not a religion-neutral society, which is what people think we are.
And you suggest that applying a Christian lens to the study of other religions often reduces them to caricatures.
Yeah. One of the things that happens when we try to collect data on non-Abrahamic faiths, even, let's say, is the sense that this congregational bias is put upon them. So here's what I mean by that. When we want to start Christian churches, folks will do field work, ethnographic field work, go to churches, see what's going on. They'll go to synagogues and see what's going on. And that's when we start talking about levels of religiosity and what, you know, the religion looks like in those places. So what happens is you go to a Gurdwara, which is a Sikh house of worship, or you go to a Hindu temple, and then that's seen as what Hinduism or Sikhism is like in America. But that's not the only way those religions are practiced. We have a lot of home worship. We have individual things that are done. And so, you know, researchers need to take a look at how they're approaching the study of.
But when Jews who, religious Jews who can't do business on Saturday complained about Sunday laws, they were often portrayed as wanting special rights.
Yes. And that's often what's happened to the conversation around religious minorities wanting to take their place in this country, if you will. It's worth noting this idea of special rights really. The conservative Christian movement did a wonderful job on messaging, as they often do, and started labeling gay and lesbian folks who wanted marriage equality as wanting special rights. Mm. And I think that when we hear this language of special rights, it has to be a red flag for people who believe in wanting equity and justice. So when Jews were, quote-unquote, complaining, or there's a sense that other religions should also be recognized. They're not asking for special rights. They're asking to be part of the country the way Christian denominations have been.
Equal rights.
Equal rights. That's right.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Kyathi Y. Joshi, a professor of education at Fairleigh Dickinson University. Her latest book is White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America, published by New York University Press. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. The Puritan settlement in Plymouth is an important part of the founding story of America. And part of that story of the Puritans is that they were persecuted in England, but when they came here, weren't they intolerant of other religious views?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this is one of the myths that we have to debunk. And, you know, right now we're starting to debunk many myths around race, and we need to do it around religion as well. We all pretty much kind of in first grade learn that this country was founded on the ideas of religious freedom. But no, the Puritans were coming here in search of religious freedom only for themselves. And we know this because what happened to the indigenous peoples who were here and the way that Native Americans were identified as savage, as uncivilized, at where the Puritans and Christians are civilized. So we have to start reteaching and rethinking some of the really codified parts of U.S. history that are continuing to cause us problems.
And we like to think of ourselves as a nation of immigrants, and yet policies in Washington these days would suggest something else. I'm not sure that Emma Lazarus would be all that proud of what's going on, considering the poem that she wrote that's on the Statue of Liberty. You mentioned this, the courts. Between 1878 and 1952, 52 court cases, including two heard by the Supreme Court, were argued to determine who would be considered white under that naturalization act, the original one that restricted citizenship to free white men. To what degree did the cases' outcomes turn on religion?
Well, this is really fascinating and a little complicated and nuanced, but it's such an important part in terms of understanding race and religion in America. So you had folks coming from present-day, what we would call the present-day Middle East during that time was called Greater Syria, and people coming from Asia, and people wanted to be citizens. And Asians particularly were identified as aliens ineligible for citizenship. So the folks petitioned the courts, sometimes sued. And in some cases, folks got citizenship, in some cases didn't. Being Christian played a role. I would not say that it decisively impacted every case, but it played a role. And in the two cases that went to the Supreme Court, religion absolutely plays a role. So first you have the Takao Ozawa case in 1922, and then you have the Bhagat Singh Thind case in 1923. Now, in 1922 in the Ozawa case, he was Japanese, and he wanted to be a citizen, and he wrote his own brief, and in it he said he takes his children, he takes his family to a Christian church, and he identifies as a Christian. Now, what's significant here is that he was really trying to prove that he was white, because whiteness was the key to citizenship. And this is also the era, Leonard, of scientific racism. And what I'm referring to there are the academic theories that were propagated to prove the superiority of white people and the inferiority of black people, and people of other backgrounds fell in between. So the courts relied on this scientific racism, and they said, Mr. Ozawa, you are mongoloid. You are not caucasoid based on science. So he was not going to get citizenship. So Thind's lawyers, Bhagat Singh Thind, was a Sikh man. He wore a turban. He had a long beard. He had dark skin. He served in the United States Army during World War I. And he was initially granted citizenship, and then it was revoked because the government filed an appeal. And the government, Leonard, said, now I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but not a whole lot, look at this guy. He's not going to fit in. And so his case goes all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And what Finn's lawyers did is they argued he was a high caste Hindu, therefore trying to claim that he was Aryan. And again, remember, this is the time of scientific racism. So there is this idea that folks from northern India were Aryans coming from the Caucasus Mountains, i.e. light-skinned, i.e. Caucasian. So that's what his lawyers were arguing. And the Supreme Court, the justices said, you may be Caucasian, but you are not white as the common man understands you to be. So wow. Right, and even, there.
So he wasn't granted citizenship.
He was not granted citizenship.
Well, now there are many Sikhs who are considered American citizens, but there have been debates over whether they should be allowed to serve in the military with kesh, unshorn hair, and a dastar, the turban, or whether we, there's also the matter of serving pork in prisons to accommodate Muslim and Jewish inmates. These are things that we kind of don't even think much about, but they are really important, aren't they? I mean, they're all part of the story that you're telling.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And whenever these rights are often granted, they've done so because people have fought for them and, you know, had to ask for them and fight for them. I think the other piece is that whenever you hear, you know, this question, well, should we allow pork not to be served in prisons to accommodate Muslim inmates, or should we allow Sikhs to serve in the military? What that should also tell us is that we're talking about these issues against a white Christian norm, right? Because so we have to reframe these questions if we're actually working towards equality and working to make sure folks can practice their religions freely, because
I know,
those questions inherently set up a norm.
Religion has nothing to do with this, but vegetarians and vegans also don't want to eat pork. But that's a whole other matter. You begin your exploration of citizenship not at the country's founding, but with Barack Obama, our 44th president.
Yeah. President Obama actually, the experiences he had are quite illustrative to think about all that goes into how we think about American citizenship. For example, he had a father who was not a U.S. citizen, who was from Kenya, and some of the images always relayed through when he was running for president and then during the 8 years he served was showing his relatives potentially back in Kenya and really depicting them as being very backwards and uncivilized and trying to peg that on him. His name, Barack Hussein Obama, when his political opponents wanted to remind people that he is not one of us, you would all often hear them not only say Hussein, but really emphasize that in pronunciation. Then there's the part where he grew up in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, bringing up this idea of, well, he's partially perhaps from over there, and it conjures up this idea of Asians and Asian Americans as perpetual foreigners. You have Asian Americans here who've been here 3, 4, 5 generations that are not still considered American and are asked, well, where are you from? So that was coming along in President Obama's story. And then while President Obama identified as a Christian, that was not only contested and questioned, but also African-American Christianity is not something familiar to white Christianity. And so that was another way that he was set apart. So just these four factors combined, you know, to really illuminate all the questions that arise for who is a citizen and then, of course, who could be our president.
We've mentioned citizenship laws, but how much of an influence did European Christianity have on the institution of slavery, on manifest destiny and the Western and the westward expansion, on immigration in general?
Christianity is there from the very beginning. We have a papal decree in the 15th century with the doctrine of discovery that essentially said that if the European empires come upon land not inhabited by Christians and claimed for a monarchy, it's theirs.
We actually did talked a lot about this on a recent show because a guest discussed the doctrine of Christian discovery. In 1452, Pope Nicholas V authorized any European Christian monarch who discovers non-Christian lands has a right to claim a superior and paramount title to those lands and also its non-Christian peoples. And that's a justification for slavery.
That's
something that continued into this country?
Yes, absolutely. It was the justification for slavery. It was the justification for the killing of Native Americans and the taking of land. And that's what the whole goal was, sea to shining sea. Right? Because this has all been ordained by God. And so Christianity is there from the get-go and before.
And then you have recent things like the white supremacist marchers in Charlottesville chanting, "The Jews shall not replace us." I wasn't exactly sure what they thought they were going to be, the Jews were going to replace them with, other than joining their group?
Right, that's a common theme, unfortunately, throughout history, throughout world history and United States history, the way that Jews have been seen as the enemy, Jews have been seen as the other.
And George Soros.
I'm sorry?
George Soros is behind everything that
right.
A bunch of people disagree with.
That's right. I mean, this idea of the Jewish conspiracy that they're trying to take over is nothing new, and I think that's a really perfect area, actually, a perfect example, that if we aren't teaching these things that have happened, if we aren't teaching the 1,000 times throughout world history that Jews have been blamed and have been criticized and have been persecuted, and then, of course, we know during World War II what Hitler was trying to do in terms of annihilation, it's going to keep coming up. I mean, what happened in Charlottesville in August of 2017 was alarming, but it's been there. It's that time it was really on the national stage, but we've got smaller events often happening that are not getting the attention they should.
Even before World War II, we had Father Coughlin, rather popular preacher on the radio, spouting anti-Semitic things. Isn't the phrase "the separation of church and state" derived from a term coined by Thomas Jefferson, who said the wall of separation between church and state? What did he mean by a wall? And doesn't it suggest the creation of a secular state?
Well, that's that's what we've been debating for the last 200 years, isn't it? He wrote that phrase, a wall of separation of church and state, in a letter to the Danbury Danbury congregation in Connecticut, because they were concerned about which denomination would have potentially become a state religion, and they were concerned that we didn't have one. This letter was in 1802, and his goal there was to assuage their fears that there wasn't going to be a denominational takeover. This interesting thing is, this letter, this phrase was almost forgotten until the 1940s and 50s, when we started seeing some cases around religion and education, and then in the 60s we get cases around religion and schools.
The Supreme Court referenced it in a 1947 case.
Yes. The 1947 case with Everson. And the goal was never to take religion out of society. The goal was to make sure government didn't have a say in how you could practice. The truth is, governments had a say in how you could practice, particularly if you have been of a non-Protestant faith.
But rather than being a protection for the religious freedoms of the people, you argue that the First Amendment was ultimately designed to be a religious mutual assurance pact agreed upon by the major competing Protestant denominations in the original 13 colonies. How did that work?
Well, there is a sense that, you know, and again, this is somewhat part of our mythology, that everybody came together and nobody wanted an official state religion, and that's how we got no state religion. And that's not the entire story. There was a little bit of what I kind of call middle school politics going on here, which is, if I can't have it my way, you're not going to get it your way. And that was a way to make sure, that's the mutual assurance pact. It was a way to make sure that one denomination wasn't favored and that we did end up with a, on paper at least, a secular democracy.
I have to take a little break here. I'll be back with more of this conversation in a few minutes on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Conversation with Dr. Kiyathi Y. Joshi, I'd like to take a few minutes to ask you to consider contributing to the station to help us get back on our feet after this pandemic has decimated our sources of funding. And by sources of funding, I mean you and your fellow listeners. That's why we need everyone who tunes into Leonard Lopate at Large and is able to donate to step up right now by going to our website, give2wbai.org. That's give and then the number 2wbai.org, or by calling 516-620-3602 to help keep this show and this station on the air. And one great way to support WBAI without having to lay out a lot of money at one time is to become a BAI buddy. There are listeners who contribute $10 or more, $10, $15, $20, whatever they can afford, to keep the station running and to show their support for what we do on this show. And anyone who signs up right now to become a BAI buddy can receive a copy of the book that we've been discussing, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. It's a great way to support the station during this difficult time and get this really important book for yourself or to give to a friend. And I'll bet you know someone who would really be particularly engaged in this topic. So make that pledge right now, and we'd be happy to send it to you or to them in your name. This is the sort of topic that we are discussed regularly on this show rather than I know the pandemic is important and coronavirus is important and the marches are important, but you can get all of that information, very good presentations elsewhere and on other shows on WBAI. We think that there are other things that also are important to discuss. And I'm totally grateful to WBAI for giving me this opportunity to invite guests like today's guest, Professor Joshi. But we can't do it without your help. And at whatever level you're comfortable donating at, the important thing is that you come through for us with a show of your support so that we can continue to bring you these long-form interviews on topics that we hope will be of interest and importance to you. Again, if you call right now and become a BAI buddy, $10 a month or more, which allows us to plan for the future, gives us some cash flow. We would be happy to send you a copy of White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. This station depends on the support of listeners like you, so if you haven't already, why not make that call at 516-620-3602 or by going to our website, givetowbai.org. And I hope you'll do it right now. I am going to continue this conversation about White Christian Privilege, the Illusion of Religious Equality in America, published by New York University Press. And my guest, Kyathi Y. Joshi, professor of, at Fairleigh Dickinson University, the author and co-author of a number of other books on related subjects. Let's get back to some of this whole matter of the separation of church and state. The Supreme Court has made all sorts of decisions on it. There was Engel, 1962, and Shemp, 1963. What were they all about?
Let me also first say, Leonard, I hope that the book provides you all and brings in some resources for the radio.
Oh, I think it's a valuable book.
I'm glad to be part of that effort. Engel in 62 and Shemp in 63 are very important. They were both about taking prayer and Bible readings out of school. And what happened was, is that instead of understanding that's what the Supreme Court was doing, the conservative Christian movement really started marketing this as government is taking religion out of schools. And that's not what they were doing. They were taking God. They were taking prayer and Bible reading. Indeed, Justice Clark, in the Abington v. Shemp decision, and he was writing for the majority, said that one's education is not complete without the study of religion. But the messaging from the Christian conservative movement won, and there's been a sense over the last few decades that religion doesn't belong in schools. I work with teachers. I teach students who are going to become future teachers also, and there is always this sense that we can't talk about religion in schools, and that's just not true. But it emanates from this idea that religion was taken out of schools by these two court cases when that's just not what they were about. It was about taking out prayer and Bible reading.
Mm-hmm. So we can discuss religion and the development of religions, although we would try to do it in a dispassionate way, but we would not start off the day with a prayer.
That's correct. We wouldn't start off the day with prayer. We would not have students engage in any kind of ritual. But you absolutely can study religions and study what rituals religious groups engage in. That's how we learn about people. That's how we learn about societies. You know?
Oh. Go ahead.
We can't understand so many issues without having a framework of religion. How do you understand Middle East politics? How do you understand what's going on between India and Pakistan? You know, unless you do have an understanding of religion. So we have to remember that it's needed in terms of understanding global events, national events. And also, sometimes people will say to me, well, we don't want religion here. Well, guess what? Religion is in the schools. They are not religiously neutral. Christianity is there. In what is taught, in the holidays we get off. So we have to do away with this idea that we're working in a religion-neutral or even race-neutral society.
Religion just came up in a Supreme Court decision about Roe v. Wade.
Yes, that happened, I believe, just this morning.
Yes.
Right? And I think it's going to further... you know, white Christian America, and I'm categorizing it as such, is segments of white Christian America are feeling under attack. And that is really instigating fear. And that's so much where our political problems and political divides are coming from. And I think this idea of the tearing down of monuments, some of the ways, the last few Supreme Court decisions that have taken place, I think, are going to further instill fear in the conservative segment of white Christian America. You know, there is a liberal segment, but we don't often talk about that.
In the subtle distinctions that are made between what constitutes religious practices and beliefs, you argue that Christian traditions are privileged and non-Christian ones are penalized. In what ways?
Well, I think you think about how we think about prayer. You know, when you're watching television and a scene comes up, what comes up is someone sitting in a pew quietly, probably hands folded. It's not someone laying themselves in front of deities, what you might find if you go, for example, to a Hindu temple. And if you do see that, then that gets characterized, discussed as something different, as something odd, because the way to pray, the normal way to pray, is to sit hands folded quietly. So we view so many aspects of religion through a Christian lens, and on a certain level, it's not necessarily right or wrong. I just need people to see that that's what we're doing, so that when you are making fun of, for example, the way some Hindu gods are depicted, we have Krishna, who is often blue, we have Ganesh, who is half elephant, half human. Well, that's seen as, you know, weird and funny because the depiction of God, which is the cover of my book, you know, is the gray, white hair flowing God with white, light skin and blue eyes. So it takes us back to what's considered normal and acceptable.
But the politicians, at least in this administration, have really gotten involved in all of this. In a speech at Notre Dame, Attorney General William Barr warned of, quote, the organized destruction of religious and traditional values. And the Bible seems to be sending out messages. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said, quote, I keep a Bible on my desk to remind me of God's word and the truth. And, of course, President Trump, in the year he became president, newspaper headlines forecast the likelihood that the United States would be a majority-minority nation. He wound up doing a photo op in which he held up a Bible, even though it's been pointed out more than once. He doesn't really read the Bible. But is that a symbol?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things there that you mentioned. I mean, I think that this administration particularly, but others have done it too, so these are not new topics. This constant linkage of American and Christianity and white Christianity, let's be clear. Because if we're talking about black Christianity, we say that. If we're talking about Asian Americans and Christianity, we say that. When Trump came out waving the Bible in front of St. John's Church, it was also, right, it's a symbol, it's signaling, this is what this country is about. We will make it through. Everything is going to be okay because, look here, I'm talking to you and this is what I believe in. It was also a smack in the face to the 40% of the country that is not Christian. And that's not always part of the conversation these days. The conversation has often been about racism within the church, which is a very important topic. What we also have to do and what I'm talking about with the book is how has Christianity impacted racism? And we have to look at those. Now, in terms of the issue of demographics and what you brought up, every couple of years, and, you know, the census is going on now, and I hope everyone's completed or will complete their census. But every couple of years we get these news stories about how white folks will be the minority soon. You know, sometimes it's 2040, sometimes it's 2050. And really, they're quite sensationalistic. It's really meant, I think, some of them to drive at fear. And the thing is that just because white folks might become a numerical minority, that's not going to erase 244 years of white Christian privilege, of whiteness and Christianity being embedded in our public policies and laws. That's not going away, you know, unless we make it and we work on those. So that's why it's really important to take a step back and see how our society has been constructed.
When President Trump signed Executive Order 13769, which is commonly known as the Muslim ban, in January 2017, there were many who argued that this is not who we are as a nation. But isn't there a new racial a classification called apparently Muslim?
Well, that's something that we talk about in research and in activist circles because, you know, I do workshops and run institutes for educators and other people. And often when I bring up race and racism and we're talking about discrimination, people will mention Muslims as being discriminated against racially. And so I always have to remind folks that being Muslim is a religious designation, although religion is racialized in our country. And that's why we talk about this idea of apparently Muslim. So any of us who have certain physical features, brown skin, dark hair, are labeled, particularly men, are seen as Muslim regardless of what faith they actually are.
You suggest that applying a Christian lens to the study of other religions often reduces them to caricatures.
Yeah, I think that because we can't understand the fact, well, let me rephrase that. Because we're not always aware of the fact that God, you know, some religions don't have an image of God. Some religions have many images of God. They get othered. They get seen as other and are not taken as seriously. Think about if you walk into a home decor store and you will often find statues of Buddha, you know, and people buy that Buddha and put it in their homes. Now, you know, I don't know what is in someone's heart, as President Carter has often said, but, you know, are you buying that because it looks cool and, you know, you've bought into this idea it's going to bring you peace? Or is it something you believe in? You know, this idea of religious commodification is a really, and appropriation is a real important one. I want folks to think about this. You know, yoga studios who insist on saying Sanskrit terms but butcher them, you know, it's really disrespectful. So you've got to put some thought into this and not just acquire something because it looks cool. And all of this happens because other Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, they're seen as other and not normalized.
But aren't they also, don't they also suggest that religious imagery, whether it's Buddhist or Hindu or Christian imagery, Michelangelo, for example, religious imagery is also often just really good art. If I have a statue of Buddha, might I just appreciate it as a work of Asian art?
You could. That's where this gets really, there's a lot of gray area. I want folks to think about it because sometimes people are not going beyond the superficial. You know, absolutely you can appreciate it as art, but understand that for some it also carries significant spiritual, it conveys us, there's a lot of spirituality there in terms of that particular piece of work, artwork or an item.
The concept of civil religion was popularized in the 1960s. Would that be a remedy for some of our religious tensions?
No, and actually I think that the concept of civil religion has done a tremendous amount of harm in terms of keeping us from seeing, it's basically, I believe, been a cover-up for white Christian privilege, white Christian supremacy in our society. It kind of creates a facade of shared civic rituals that transcend religion, but it's really ignoring the Christian roots. I mean, Robert Bella, who is the one who coined, well, he didn't coin the phrase, Rousseau coined the phrase, but his work is what started all the scholarship on civil religion. I mean, he said Europe is like Egypt and America is the promised land. Now, you don't get more Christian than that.
Just a couple of years ago, we don't have a heck of a lot more time, but I wanted to bring this up. In 2018, National Geographic issued an apology under the headline, "For decades, our coverage was racist." What were they referring to?
Well, I, as a child and teenager who faced a lot of bullying because of National Geographic's depictions of India, I would constantly hear, because I was fortunate to go home to India in the summers, I would often hear, "Oh, do you have a pet elephant? You know, what's your
Oh,
mud hut
really?
like?" Oh, yes. Oh, I could tell you stories, Leonard. And, you know, National Geographic, when they issued that apology, it was very personal for me because it had caused me so much pain and so many other people I know. So it was great that they did it, and the reckoning is important. They needed to go a little further and understand how Christianity was part of their colonial endeavor. I mean, National Geographic is colonialism in the sense of knowledge. And Christianity was right there with it. The way they depicted people engaged in rituals around the world, it was very much just, you know, exoticization. They're other, they're different, in some cases backwards, uncivilized. So we need to be looking at race and religion. And I'd like National Geographic to add, to provide an addendum to their apology.
Because you say they missed something really crucial there.
Yep. Very much so, which is often what has happened, and it's also symbolic of what has often happened in our country. Race and religion are really together, but because of the First Amendment, people don't see the religion, don't see the Christianity that is present along the way with whiteness.
And you also point out that we can legislate laws that would guarantee total equality, but you can't legislate attitudes.
Absolutely not. What we have to do for people changing their minds, and they have to change them. We can't make anybody change their mind, is engagement. You know, right now everybody's reading a lot about race in America, which is great, but we're going to have to do more than read. We're going to have to engage. And what that means is providing forums, providing workshops, providing institutes where people can come and kind of hash things out. They've got to be allowed to say things like, you know, "Well, no, I don't believe in affirmative action," or, "No, you know, this religion doesn't deserve to be here." There has to be a place where they can say these things to learn and process why they're thinking what they're thinking, where they've gotten their information. None of this is going to happen overnight. Certainly not going to happen in a 2-hour, you know, implicit bias training that sometimes schools and companies want to do. I think there's a little bit of a sea change there we're seeing right now, and understanding you've got to be in it for the long haul in order to really make change.
Kiyati Y. Joshi is a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, author of New Roots in America's Sacred Ground, Religion, Race, and Ethnicity in Indian America, co-editor of Teaching for Diversity and Social Justice, and her most recent, the one we've been discussing, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America, published by New York University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. If you're new to our program and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as an iTunes podcast, and you can find links to all of our past shows on our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter. If you'd like to comment on this or any of our shows, you can write to me at leonardlopate@wbai.org. Before I sign off today, I'd like to take just one last moment to ask you for your support for this station. If you value Leonard Lopate at Large and all of the other great programs on WBAI, we need your help to keep this operation alive. Please step up right now and make a contribution at whatever amount you are comfortable with. And as I mentioned earlier, if you become a BAI buddy right now by making a monthly contribution to become a sustaining member with a contribution of $10 or more in the name of this show, you can receive a copy of the book that we've been discussing, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. But in order to get that book, you have to sign up to become a BAI buddy. right now. So please go to our website, give2wbai.org, or call 516-620-3602 to support the unique in-depth content that we bring you on this show. And please be sure to make that contribution in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. We hope that you will do it, because this is a really difficult time for not only WBAI, but for all public radio stations. In our case, perhaps a bit more, because we don't take money from advertisers. We don't take foundation money. We rely totally on our listeners. Please make that call. We're off tomorrow, but we'll be back on Wednesday with our favorite masters of home repair, Alvin and Lawrence Ubell. We'll see you then.
Global cases of coronavirus now exceed 10 million, and more than 500,000 people have died around the world. More than 2.5 million people have tested positive for the new coronavirus in the United States, and more than 125,000 have died here. The surge in cases in the U.S. is most pronounced in southern and western states that did not follow health officials' recommendations to wait for a steady decline in cases before reopening. California ordered some bars to close on Sunday. Governor Gavin Newsom's order for bars to close in Los Angeles and six other counties followed moves by Texas and Florida to shut all their bars on Friday. Public health officials have identified bars as the riskiest non-essential businesses currently open. A federal judge has ordered Immigration and Customs Enforcement to release immigrant children from its family detention centers due to concerns over rising coronavirus infections. The order affects two immigrant prisons in Texas and one in Pennsylvania, as well as facilities housing unaccompanied minors. Last week, court documents revealed 11 immigrants held inside a prison for families in Texas tested positive for COVID-19. At least 750 ICE prisoners and 45 ICE workers have tested positive for the coronavirus. The Supreme Court struck down a major abortion case today. The court ruled that a Louisiana law that requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, severely limiting access to abortion, is unconstitutional. The vote was 5-4, with Chief Justice John Roberts siding with the court's liberal justices to strike the law down. In another significant move, the Supreme Court decided not to take up a challenge to new federal death penalty protocols proposed by the Justice Department, clearing the way for the Trump administration to carry out the first executions in the federal criminal justice system in 17 years. Three executions have been set for July and one for August, all at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. The White House will brief members of Congress today on intelligence reports that Russia offered to pay members of the Taliban to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan. President Trump called the original report by the New York Times possibly another fabricated Russian hoax. According to the Times, Trump was briefed on the operation, but Trump denied it, tweeting Sunday night that neither he nor Vice President Mike Pence had been briefed. The Washington Post reported Sunday night that U.S. intelligence officials believe the Russian bounties did cause deaths of American troops in Afghanistan, according to recent interrogation of captured militants. In Aurora, Colorado, police used pepper spray on crowds Saturday as thousands took to the streets, shutting down an interstate as they called for justice for Elijah McClain, who was killed by police last year. McClain, a 23-year-old African-American man, was tackled by police as he headed home from a local convenience store, placed in a chokehold, and then injected with ketamine by paramedics. At Saturday's protest for McClain, a group of violinists held a vigil playing violins, the instrument McClain also played at shelters for cats, in his honor. Colorado Governor Jared Polis announced that a special prosecutor would reopen a probe into the killing of Elijah McClain. United Nations top human rights official Michelle Bachelet urged Israel today to suspend its illegal plans to annex part of Palestinian-occupied territory in the West Bank and warned it could result in deadly clashes. Mostly sunny this afternoon. Currently in Washington, it's sunny and 90. In New York,